Well, this hour we're going to talk about safety, what needs to be done for school staff members, parents, law enforcement, with our guest Kurt Lavarello. He's next on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back to Coast. I'm George Norrie with our guest Kurt Lavarello. Kurt is part of an organization called School Safety 911. We're going to talk with him not only about this episode today, but how can we effectively deal with child safety. That's the important thing. Hey, Kurt, how are you?
Good morning, George. How are you?
Good to have you with us. No need to get your reaction, obviously, to this situation. The big story now is moving ahead, how to protect our children. There's got to be no bigger fear, Kurt, than to hear a story like today and wonder, even though it's sad, wonder if your child has been involved in this situation.
Absolutely. It's got to be, you know, not only for the parents of the children who go to Virginia Tech, but every parent who wakes up this morning and has a child that they're sending off to school, there's going to be some hesitancy to do so. And that's oftentimes what's accomplished out of these horrific school shootings.
Tell us a little bit about the organization and the website you head up.
The School Safety Advocacy Council, basically, we're a group of law enforcement officials, school officials, and what we do is advocate for sensible legislation that deals with schools. One of the issues currently on our plate right now is trying to lobby those on Capitol Hill, for school crime reporting statutes. Right now, Your listeners may find it's hard to believe, there is not one single piece of legislation that mandates national crime reporting on a school campus. So when we say school crime is down, like we hear coming out of the Department of Ed every year, that's really just a best guess. We really have no clue as to whether school crime is up, down, or otherwise.
That's sad that we don't have that kind of data.
It's absolutely, it's so crazy. I mean, literally, there are folks like myself and some other colleagues in the field that we track school crime through the media. And when people get upset with the media that, you know, that you're reporting these incidents, it's really our only way right now. There's no mandate to report school crime. Some states have some mandate. What makes it worse is the No Child Left Behind law that came out years ago has a special provision of that law that's a persistently dangerous school. So if a school reports certain crimes to a certain level within that state, they could become labeled as the persistently dangerous school. Well, I've always said it myself. If I were the police chief of a persistently dangerous town, wouldn't the first thing you do is probably fire me?
Absolutely.
So we're still kind of backwards on that, and we're really knocking on doors up in D.C. to try to get some folks to wake up and say, hey, you know, the FBI requires UCI crime reporting for cities and towns and communities. Why can't schools do it? And that's part of the problem.
And would you say this is across the country? Are there any particular school districts, in your opinion, that are doing a good job?
Oh, there are a number of school districts that do a good job. And sometimes they're very small districts. Sometimes they're very large districts. They test and they flex these crisis plans. They actually run through tabletop exercises. I know Clark County Schools in Las Vegas, they did a multitude of drills and actually put schools and communities through a national drill. How fast could they lock off a particular area of the community? And those drills are becoming increasingly important to schools and communities because you have to be able to test. And when I think the questions that are going to come out of yesterday's incident that occurred are going to be the communication. How fast did they get the word out on an incident that lasted well over 3 hours?
Well, that is absolutely one of the things that I think will haunt that school. At a university, because of the slowness, and they also thought it was an isolated issue, and they didn't expect him, I guess, to come back, huh?
Well, it sounds that way. The early reports are that I think they were initially looking at it as some type of a domestic disturbance, and that they had the two deceased and the gunman still loose, and therein lies the problem. I know they likened, I heard several news reports where they said, well, this was a large campus, almost like a community, so it's hard to notify an entire community. Well, the bottom line is that community consists of children. It's no different than a large high school. And when you have, the key is the gunman is loose. And folks have to know, you don't want students walking into harm's way if there's still a gunman loose on that campus. And it's still going to unfold, but I think there are going to be a lot of questions that have to be answered.
How do you feel about teachers being able to carry guns, concealed weapons?
Well, you know, having my background is law enforcement, and, you know, I am against it, absolutely. You know, putting teachers out there and having, there's just a lot more that goes with just carrying the guns. And even the training they talk about, there's some legislation. I know it took place in Nevada to allow teachers to carry guns and several other states. The problem is, once you introduce those, any typical campus, 30, 40 more guns on the campus, you run the risk of having those wind up in the wrong hands. And I would be against that right from the very beginning.
You think because maybe a teacher could get strong-armed or something like that?
Well, yeah, there are a lot of questions. And it's one thing to go through training to hit targets in a relaxed situation. It's another thing when your adrenaline's pumping and there's an active shooter on campus. If you had a situation like yesterday where teachers are now out there looking for the armed gunman or arming themselves, who's to say they're not going to see a non-uniform police officer? There's just a lot going on that could just add to the chaos.
You know, it's kind of ironic, Kurt, here in Missouri, when they finally passed their concealed weapons bill a few years ago, most of the police chiefs in the state were opposed to it, maybe politically, but many of the rank-and-file police officers were in favor of it.
Yeah. And that's at times typical among, specific communities that say, hey, you know, the more guns we have, the more likely the gunman is not to, you know, pull a stunt like yesterday. But on the surface, I'd have to say I'd be against it. I think most of the colleagues in the law enforcement community would be against it as well.
Well, now, when we deal with school safety, could this issue, this episode, have been avoided? I don't think so. Your thoughts?
No, you know, I've said it all day long today on radio shows that these are very, very tough situations, especially where somebody's coming in with the mindset at the end of this all, I'm going to end my own life. You know, we could probably have 100 new gun laws, and I'm not sure they would have prevented this gentleman from stopping what he was going to do that day. We've got to go back before that and look at things we could have done. We're such a resilient nation. We bounce back quick from incidents like this. Yet with that resiliency, we become complacent, and that the complacency state is where we have our most problems.
If he were a suicide bomber, he couldn't have been stopped either.
I don't think so. You know, it's very, very difficult in today's, just the makeup, the structures of the physical environment, would be very, very difficult to stop.
So what do you recommend? What do we do?
Well, I think, we got to go back to the basics. I'm sure every person who sells alarms and I'm sure every person who sells cameras are going to be calling colleges today and sending emails to say their technology is the piece that could have prevented this. We got to go way before that. We have to create a campus that's conducive to good communication. The one good piece of data that we do have from the Secret Service when they profiled all these school shooters years ago was the fact that before all these horrific shootings, kids knew something was going wrong. We got to create an environment where kids will communicate with adults, where they'll understand that things can happen on their campus, because no one ever wants to believe it can happen there, and create an environment that there is a lot of communication beforehand. And that's the start. The other side of the coin there, though, is that we also have to we have to take these crisis plans off the shelf, dust them off, and put them to work, test them. Because oftentimes we do find, I go into school safety assessment situations all the time, and I find the police department has a response plan, the school has a response plan, the fire department has a response plan. We have three different response plans, and when it hits the fan, there's a lot of chaos.
Lots of chaos, indeed. Kurt, we'll take phone calls with you when we come back at the half hour because I want everybody involved in this particular episode. Do other countries have similar problems?
You know, sadly enough, I heard it said today earlier, and I have to echo the same comment. I think here in the United States, we hold the copyright on the school shootings. It seems to be the most popular way of gaining attention here. And we've said that even as we look forward to the potential of a terroristic act on a school campus, if you want to garner the hearts of Americans, put our kids at risk. And that's often what we're seeing.
Well, that is another scary part of this whole equation, because you have the media so widespread now. Terrorists are probably watching what unfolded today. I don't doubt that at all. Do you?
No, and what's alarming, as you said, is that not only are they watching what's unfolding, but they very well could be sitting back and taking a good look at the panic that situations like this cause. And therein is the key to terrorism, is creating panic. So, you know, the folks at Homeland Security have to be taking a good look at this as well.
Absolutely. I mean, how unfortunate. As police officers, when you first arrive on the scene after you get that horrible, frightening 911 call, what do you do?
Well, you know, Columbine, and we're coming up on the anniversary of Columbine this Friday. Columbine was really the case that changed police response. Years back, and I was on the force then, and I responded to several school shootings back before Columbine. The mode that we operated in was to set up a perimeter, keep people out of the perimeter, and wait for the experts, those being the SWAT teams and the special response teams, and we'd wait for them to move in. Columbine changed all that. We, you know, law enforcement agencies across the country woke up and said, hey, we can't sit back while kids are dying and wait for the experts. We all have to go in. So training began around the country to train just the line level officer to respond and move in quickly. And it does seem like that's what occurred here in Pennsylvania in several of the school shootings, as well as the today's shooting in Virginia.
Well, there's no doubt about that. School Safety 911, what do people find at that website?
Well, they'll find a series of things. The training we do around the country, primarily we train law enforcement agencies. We also train school districts. We do school crisis assessments to communities. And those are the questions I think that people have to ask tomorrow morning. I know I have two children that go to school here in Sarasota, and a long time ago, I knocked on the door of both their principals, and I wanted to know how easy it is to get on their campus, how long I could stay on their campus without an adult coming over to me and saying, why are you here? Who are you? And what safeguards do my children's schools have to keep, you know, visitors off campus that don't belong there? And those are some things that I think your listeners can do tomorrow.
Though there seems to be a fire restriction, how do you feel about doors being locked when the bell goes off?
You know, I like the idea, and it differs from town to town as to what the fire codes are and what the but again, you know, we train kids. It's one point I've made all day long, is we train kids all day long, or I should say all year long in a school. And kids know from the first grade what to do when the fire alarm goes off. They know where to go, they know where to stage, and they know that all throughout their school career. Yet we don't do the same kind of drills for school shootings. We've never lost a kid in a fire, and we've lost, you know, hundreds in school shootings, and so we have to start taking a good look at where we're losing our kids.
And you do not think that this is going to be the last?
Absolutely not. Sadly enough, I can say I spoke last Friday in San Francisco, California, at the National School Board Conference, and I said our next school shooting is probably just around the corner, and I'm not the amazing Kreskin, but I can just tell you that we still operate in this mode of it can't happen here, and unless we get out of that mode, we'll continue to see these horrific events.
Is it expensive to defend a school?
There are some very simple, basic things we can do. Naturally, technology can help, especially on a campus as large as the University of Virginia Tech there. It could be very, very costly for schools to outfit themselves with a camera in each hallway. But there are some simple things that schools can do just to engage faculty and staff when you go to the grade level on visitors. Who's on our campus, visitor check-in procedures, one central point for schools to check in. And that's a lot more difficult. I do understand that on a college-level campus where you have adults coming and going all day long. But technology can be helpful as well.
You know, the old saying, people in the right minds wouldn't do something like this. This individual, and I'm sure they'll get into it, probably was very, very sick and distraught. And as our previous guest had said, might have had some kind of damage in some form or fashion with his brain.
Oh, absolutely. And I think that's one of the things I've noticed over the past probably 10 to 15 years, some of these school shooters, I think when they see them, the ones that haven't killed themselves, you just see this blank stare on their face that they've, a lot of our kids have become so desensitized to killing. It's almost as if we've programmed them into these killing machines, and I think that's where you're going to see a lot of focus on some of the research that's coming out in the future.
They're almost as if, Kurt, they are possessed.
Well, I have a colleague in the field, Dave Grossman, and Dave's an excellent guy, Lieutenant Colonel Grossman. He, part of his job was to train our troops to be desensitized to killing when we went to war. And some of the same techniques they used to desensitize our troops via the video games to keep moving forward, we've done in a way in our community with our video games that are out there now. We've programmed to just move forward, kill, kill, kill. And so I think you're gonna see some tie-ins to that in the coming days. You're going to start hearing a lot of chatter about that. Very, very scary on the side.
Well, so you think video games might have some kind of contributing factor to all of this?
I do, and I can see it in my own child. That the fantasy, when as he comes home, I got a 9-year-old boy, and he comes home and he's telling me, "Dad, he knows this new game, and the game involves killing and getting points for how many cars you steal and how many people you kill or rape." And there's absolutely no way I'm letting my child play something like that. But they're some of the hottest selling games out there on
yeah.
the market.
No, you're right, Kurt. Also, what it does is I think it enhances a kid's dexterity. I mean, they become almost experts at either marksmanship or whatever they do. I mean, it is a virtual reality training program.
Oh, absolutely. And now they have them. It's not even you're just handling the controller, but you're standing in front of the TV set with a controller that's actually a gun. And people are coming at you. So I think there's some validity to the fact that we've got to start looking at what we're passing on to our children via the media market and the games that are out there.
When I was a kid, we used to play. We'd have our toy guns. We'd have cap guns. They were cap guns. I mean, they made the little pop sound. But I got to tell you, not once did I ever think about wanting to kill someone or to point a real gun at someone. I knew, even at the age of 8, 9, or 10, that it was a toy. My friends did, too. We played cops and robbers, and we did the whole thing. Why were we okay then, playing with guns? I mean, today, you look at kids running around the street with guns, people would freak.
Right.
Toy guns.
Absolutely. And as a matter of fact, there's states that have now state laws that toy guns have to be painted certain colors so that law enforcement doesn't take it as a real gun.
As a real gun, sure.
And that's some of the stuff we're seeing today. I mean, there certainly is. I saw a study once on the number of deaths by shooting that kids watch in TV today versus what we may have watched in the 60s. And the number just, I mean, it was just on, you certainly didn't see it on Green Acres or Petticoat Junction. And it's changed. It's changed considerably. My kids, even myself, they sit home and watch TV, and you can't watch them 24 hours a day. And they are exposed to a lot more violence than we were as kids.
Well, there's no question about that. And again, the website, schoolsafety911.com. That'll get people to the school safety website. We're going to open up the phone lines now. Kurt, we're going to keep you one more half hour, and then that'll be it. I know it's been a long night for you, and we will take phone calls for our guest, Kurt Lavarello. And what's home for you? Whereabouts?
I'm in Sarasota, Florida.
Okay. Well, you stick with us. I'm George Norrie. You can email me at coasttocoastam.com. During the last hour of our program tonight, we'll have pure open lines for you. Anything goes, so you don't have to talk with us just about this tragedy that occurred at Virginia Tech. So the last hour tonight, we'll have open lines. We've got Howard Bloom coming back in next hour, but we'll take your phone calls with our guest in just a moment at Coast to Coast AM. Yes, we're going to take your phone calls now, so we will be right back on Coast to Coast AM. And let's take the phone calls. We'll go to our first-time caller line. You're on the air with us. Hi there.
Hello. Is this me?
Yes, sir. Take it away.
Yes, sir. I just want to start by saying I think you do a good job hosting Mr. Norrie. I want to cut straight to the point. I've been living here in central Virginia and around southwest Virginia for about 10, 15 years somewhere in there. But I shoot with a lot of people around Blacksburg. We go up to the Newcastle area right around there and do a lot of shooting. And I wanted to comment on what the fellow that was on the show before was saying about the faculty not being able to carry guns. I mean, I was a grunt in the Marine Corps for an enlistment, and nobody knows what to do when the shooting starts. I mean, you know what to do, but, I mean, it's not some law enforcement or anybody else is going to snap right into this combat mindset. You know, mm-hmm. You just got to do what you got to do when it's there. But I'll tell you what, there's 33 people today that are 32 that weren't him, I guess, that wish they were packing at that time. I'll tell you that right now. I mean, I go to the gun shows around that area. I've heard a lot of speculation. It's not as easy as they're saying to buy a firearm in Virginia. They do a background check. And if you don't come up on a background check, you can walk out with a gun right there. It doesn't matter, two days, 10 days, it doesn't matter. If you don't have a record, you don't have a record. You know, you got to sign stuff that says you don't have, mental problems or you don't have drug addictions, mm-hmm. like a lot of stuff you got to fill out. I mean, hell, a lot of guys I know complain about how much stuff you got to fill out now. I mean, it's not as easy as they're saying. If you want to get a gun on the street, you're going to get a gun on the street. I mean, do you look at England? Their gun control policy has failed completely. The cops over there weren't carrying when they were, like, when guns were legal. Now they're carrying and guns are illegal. I mean, it doesn't make much sense to me.
All right, well, let's get Kurt. We'll get your reaction to this because you're not in favor of those, definitely not the students, but you're not in favor of the teachers carrying.
No, George, it kind of reminds me, years ago there was a comedy show called All in the Family with Archie Bunker, and Archie's way to stop air hijackings, if you remember, was as everybody's getting on a plane, you hand them a gun. And some of the legislation that we've seen introduced is likened to that comedy show. The answer is never going to be to increase the amount of guns on a school campus. I think we'd be looking at it foolishly. Now, your caller makes a good point in that, everybody's in a panic mode, including the law enforcement officials, and that's probably true. Everybody from law enforcement is in a panic mode. But the one thing I do have to say that we in the law enforcement community and first responders have done post-Columbine has been to prepare. It's not just that we prepare on a gun range and go out there and get our qualifications. Law enforcement officials go through a series of qualifications that include high-profile response to these situations. So it's much more in-depth, much more detailed now than just going to a pistol range and shooting targets for a qualification.
Let's go to our wild card line. You're on the air with us. Hello there. Good morning.
Hi. What I'd like to point out is we have free TV because commercials work and people are influenced by that. Yet each channel has well over 1,000 violent acts per day, and we feel at home at letting our children watch TV and babysit.
Well, one of the things I think, Kurt, you were saying, you got to watch what your kids are watching.
Absolutely. I mean, it's not the school's responsibility 100% to sit back and prevent these things, but the prevention starts at home. And your caller is absolutely right. I mean, they're exposed. If we just give them what they want, I mean, they're exposed to a lot more than we were as children. I mean, I can flip on, I've got 900 channels on a satellite TV here in my house that kids can flip through. That's certainly a lot more than the 12 we had as kids. And, your call is absolutely right. We do have to monitor what our kids are watching, what they're sitting behind the computer desk doing. The emails now go back and forth between kids, text messaging. It's a lot more different than when we were growing up.
Yet most of these kids who would do all that, video games, play on the internet, maybe look at the wrong things on the internet, they'll never turn out to be killers, Kurt.
No. You know, there is something absolutely in the mindset. I think you mentioned it earlier, George. There is something in the mindset. But what we are doing, and I think probably the best case I recall was the case out in Oregon, Kip Kinkle, when he shot his mom and dad and then went on a rampage the following day at school. I still remember the video of him being led into the jail and just this blank stare of, yeah, I did it. What's the big deal?
Well, he had a damaged brain, according to the doctor who looked at it.
Well, and that's my point. I mean, so when you mix the combination of what we're exposing them to with the damage, I think therein lies the potential for a school shooter. And I go onto these campuses all the time, and I ask the faculty and staff to raise their hand if they know somebody who could be the next Clee Bolton Harris or Kip Kinkle. And typically, half the room or more are raising their hands.
And sometimes, though, isn't it the person you least suspect?
Yeah, it is. And, you know, and that's the million-dollar question, who's going to be the next kid to snap. But, you know, I think we've also done a good job post-Columbine. We've prevented a number of these horrific school shootings where these kids were, you know, armed, ready to go in and take some lives. And we've done in the New Bedford, Massachusetts came to mind, because that was one that was planned, and the police chief there and his staff really rallied around a potential, just a threat, and they stopped what probably would have been a historical large shooting.
Let's go east of the Rockies. Your turn. You're on Coast to Coast with us. Hi there.
Hi. This is Beverly.
Hi, Beverly.
I'm in the South, and 6 years ago, I used to work in a university setting in civil engineering, and we had a student that was quite strange. When he walked, he stared at the ground. He wore army boots. He stuffed his pants in his army boots. He wore an army backpack that was so big, I swear you could have put a tent in it. We had no idea what he was carrying around. I tried to talk to him. I worked up front, like in the lobby situation, and I had coworkers, and we were kind of scared of him. He had no friends, no other student friends. There were about 800 students in civil engineering at that time, and I tried to talk to him, and he gradually opened up to me, but I went to my superiors with another coworker. We had talked this over for weeks. We said, something is going to go wrong. And we went to the superiors, and they listened to us, and they just shook their heads, and they said, no, nothing's going to happen. And still, he kept on this strange behavior. When I was talking to him, he told me that he hated women. To make a long story short, I got closer to him because I felt like that he was going to do something to me. I felt like I was going to get the first shot. And he told me that he had been on testosterone most of his life, but he had taken himself off of testosterone. Well, I had him go to an endocrinologist, and the doctor put him back on testosterone, and he didn't like it. He didn't like it at all, and it made him mad. And just because my superiors would not help us in our office, in the administrative office, I started bringing my pistol to work. In my purse. It stayed right there under my feet, and I was scared.
And you were ready to use it at any moment, weren't you?
Absolutely. Absolutely. And you know, I don't want to put fear in a lot of people. You know, these kids come from all around the world, and they come from all around the world, and they're away from home for years. They're lonely. You know, they have problems. They have tragedies happen in their families, things like that. And people aren't really paying attention to this. You know, people aren't really, you know, recognizing that, you know, there might be something wrong with this kid. And I need to talk to him. I need to find out what's wrong with him. But I was really disturbed that my superiors did not, you know, he was so obviously mad and angry at everybody. And he stayed that way. And, yeah, I sat up front with, in my purse, a pistol. I was licensed to carry a pistol and trained to carry a pistol.
Where do you think he is now?
At another college. He moved on.
Still angry, I'm sure.
Probably so. I think he's probably trying to get his PhD right now. Yeah.
All right. Good. Thanks for the call. Appreciate you being part of Coast to Coast. West of the Rockies, you're on the air with us. Hi there.
Hi, George. How are you and your guests doing this evening?
We are well. Thanks.
I jumped in about halfway through your guest introduction, so I don't know if I heard him correctly, but I wanted to make sure that that the public knew that federal legislation requires that colleges and universities across the United States submit their crime statistics to the Department of Education every year. That legislation is commonly known as the Jean Clery Act, and currently over 6,000 universities and colleges across our nation submit those statistics every year. If any of your listeners are interested in more information about looking up these crime statistics, it's very easy to do. They can go to a website called securityoncampus.org. That's www.securityoncampus.org. And on the left-hand side, they'll see a link for crime stats, as well as a lot of other information about the Clery Act, and they can learn that, indeed, it is true that federal legislation requires, and over 6,000 universities and colleges across the United States do, submit crime statistics that include homicides like what happened today at Virginia Tech to the Department of Education every year. If a college or university fails to report crime statistics, they face violations of more than $40,000 per violation.
All right, and I would trust then that the statistics they report are accurate?
Not only, they're required to be accurate, of course, by federal law. If they're not accurate, then they face a fine of more than $40,000 per violation. And Security on Campus is a nonprofit group that calls for audits of institutions that they are notified by the public are not following federal legislation. And at that site, your listeners can see audits that have been performed against universities who have failed to properly disclose not just their crime statistics, but their building security and other policies related to security on campus that law requires. Indeed, your listeners can even read the Clery Act itself on that site. So,
how would Virginia Tech fare? Do you know?
Well, I have not looked up Virginia Tech's entry on the DOE website through Security on Campus, but earlier today I was looking at their annual report, which is required that they present to the public through the Clery Act. I was looking at their annual report on the web, and they do present the required crime statistics from 2003 through 2005.
So they do get it. All right, well, thanks. Let's go to our wild card line. You're on the air with us. Welcome to the program. It is your turn. Hi there.
Yeah, hi. I disagree with your guest wholeheartedly about private citizens not being able to protect their own lives. We're morally obligated to protect our own lives. Citizens think that a $50,000 a year cop is supposed to come and protect their lives and take a bullet for them? Forget it. The police are there to mop up afterwards and draw chalk lines. If citizens, and you can't call these kids today kids because they're adults in college, I don't believe grade school, but if you're 18 years old and you pass a proficiency test, you have the constitutional right to protect your own life. I don't want to be dead, and I don't want the government to be the arbiter as to whether I live or die. And you can't do anything about these nuts, because the guy that drove the plane into his mother-in-law's house with his daughter in it, he was a nut. He didn't use a gun, right? The guy that that went up to the law office, he wasn't a kid, and he shot up everybody in the law office in San Francisco. He's a 50-year-old man because they stole his patent idea. You can't stop these nuts. You must have the citizens be armed. Otherwise, and it's proven in history that you disarm the citizens, basically, it's all over. You become subjects and not citizens.
Well, I guess the theory is the nuts are going to get their weapons one way or another.
If you want to kill a lot of people, guns are very inefficient. 2 gallons of gasoline and a pack of matches, you can burn down a nightclub and kill 250 people.
Let me ask you this, Kurt, and thanks for your call. People, criminals who pick up guns, obviously they're not buying them the way non-criminals would, right? They don't register. They don't fill out applications. How do they get them?
Well, that's not necessarily true. There are a number of cases, including school-related shootings that have occurred where the culprit did buy. I mean, one of the guns at Columbine that was used at the Columbine massacre was purchased at a gun show there in town. So oftentimes at some of these gun shows, we don't do a good job of safeguarding who is in fact buying a gun. It's almost a free for all, and it differs from community to community. Mm-hmm. So there are people who are bad people, and they're buying guns very legitimately, and they keep them in their houses at times, and at times they snap. I investigated a school shooting down in Palm Beach, Florida, which involved a kid. The gun was a legitimately owned gun by a father who kept the gun in his house, and the kid snapped and got the gun and went to school and shot and killed a teacher. It differs, of course, from state to state. Now, the part I will mention with the last caller is that times have changed. He's right to say that years ago, the police were there as just the response mechanism. It was just a reactive. We were there to respond, come out, put the crime scene up, and investigate the call and respond after the incident had occurred. Those times have changed, and they've changed greatly after Columbine. There's a lot of proactive response. The Department of Education and the Department of Justice are actually talking now, and they do have law enforcement officers stationed around the country. They're called school resource officers. They're there not only to be responsive and reactive, but they're there to be proactive and keep their ears to the ground, listen to what kids are talking about. And again, I go back to that Secret Service shooting. In every one of those incidents, the key was the kids were talking about it before it occurred. And that's where we can make the greatest adjustments in our response.
All right, very good, Kurt. And again, what do you recommend people do if they want more information on this?
Well, certainly they can go to our website, www.schoolsafety911.com. I would also suggest that they go to their local schools, their local colleges where their kids go, find out what school crisis plans are in place, find out who is responsible for the security of the kids. When was the last time a drill was done at their particular college or school that their child attends, and start getting answers that way.
All right, very good. Thanks. Appreciate you being on the program, Kurt.
Thank you.
And when we come back, we'll have an hour of Howard Bloom with us, and then we will take phone calls with Howard. But then the last hour of the program tonight, I'm just going to give you pure open lines, talk about anything you want. After this special report we had in this, you might want to just simply sit back and talk and, well, try to get the day's activities off your mind. So we'll do that in the last hour with open lines. If you need to email me, just make it george@coasttocoastam.com. They're coming in tonight by the thousands. So we'll be right back on Coast to Coast AM with our very special guest tonight, Mr. Howard Bloom on Coast to Coast.